Good. So, as an introduction, postmodernism, what do we mean by that? Where's that term coming from? Well, during the 1970s, the term postmodernism became established to name a broad spectrum of new cultural trends. What exactly did it refer to? Did the term refer to? Well, literally, postmodernism signifies that which comes after modernism. Yet, the term modernism is at least as difficult to define as postmodernism. So that leaves us with the same problem, actually. Let's dive a little deeper. Let's try to find out what modernism could mean. If you take the perspective of someone living after the Second World War, modernism designates the new spirit that had transformed so many aspects of life after 1900. In literature and the visual arts as well, the tendency of experiments and radical innovations could no longer be ignored. It was proven by writers such as James Joyce, Franz Kafka, and Marcel Proust, or by painters such as Pablo Picasso, Marcel Duchamp, and Kazimir Malevich. Modernism was not just a new style, it was rather a grouping of a whole range of new tendencies, which had also dramatically changed daily life. Think, for example, of all the new aspects of the modern city. Steel and glass architecture, such as the Crystal Palace in England or the Eiffel Tower in Paris. Electricity, the petrol engine, highways, public transport. The technological changes between 1850 and 1950 had created contemporary urban life. That also required a new design and new architecture. Designers such as Le Corbusier, Walter Gropius, and L. Lisitsky showed how life in the metropolis could be organized clearly and methodically. That was only possible when the rigid shapes and dead ornaments of an outdated tradition were left behind. The decades just after the Second World War can be seen as a triumph of modernism. New cities that were emerging all over the world were modeled on the ideas that modernist artists and designers had been elaborating for at least half a century. Take, for example, the Brazilian city of Brasilia, which arose in the late 1950s. The city sprang from the ground in just only a few years. Numerous buildings were designed by one single architect, Oscar Niemeyer. He was inspired by the ideas of the French architect and visionary Le Corbusier. As soon as this total vision of design came under pressure, postmodernism started to emerge, and that moment can be situated around the year 1970. At that time, the tight functionalism of the modernists started to feel stifling for a new generation of designers and artists. What the postmodernists also opposed was the great hostility towards the past of the modernist and towards traditional art. Modernism, namely, stated that the designer only had to focus on the design brief. He made tabula rasa with the past and presented a functionalist and simplified design language. This kind of design is strongly associated with architects and designers from the German Bauhaus school or from Russian constructivism, such as Walter Gropius or Lisitsky. In the visual arts, this connected with the aspirations of many modern artists who were also striving for abstraction, for simplification. Examples include Malevich, Piet Mondrian, Umberto Boccioni, Theo van Doesburg, and Paul Klee. So the role of the modernist designer was deliberately restricted. He had to follow a program that was strictly determined by the parameters of the assignment and of the environment in which the design would be used. The postmodern designer, on the other hand, responded to the program with a playful and personal approach. He or she also claimed the freedom to reinterpret certain elements from the past in an idiosyncratic manner, individual manner, in order to create something new. A well-known example of the new postmodern approach to design is the Piazza d'Italia in New Orleans by the American architect Charles Moore. The square combines various elements from Italian Renaissance architecture in a playful, almost whimsical way. These ancient columns and porches are, as it were, quoted by the contemporary architect, by Charles Moore, in his new design. Now, I urge you to look up this design. It still exists. It was built in 1978, so it's exactly as old as I am, which is to say, fairly young. Do some research. Please look it up on Google Maps. I think it's a terrific example of postmodernism. It's a very strange thing, especially situated in its context in downtown New Orleans, in the middle of this skyscraper architecture and downtown skyscraper architecture. It looks totally logical and yet totally out of place. It's like it has, it's a very ambiguous design. So have a look at it. You can find many pictures online, of course, and you can also, well, you can even walk there using Google Street View. Another example is Parc de la Villette. It's a public park designed by the Swiss architect Bernard Tschumi for the city of Paris. And this park, the unique thing about the design is that it includes various pavilions or folies. The folie, literally it means folie is something crazy. Now they're very small buildings in steel. They are painted in a striking red color, and it's not exactly clear what the function of each pavilion is. Some can be used as a shop, as a lookout, as a shelter. Others have a much less obvious function. They are simply playful architectural elements that mark the space. You can use them or you can ignore them. The designer does not force the park user or visitor into the straitjacket of a certain function. The user has the freedom to fill in the program of the building, to contribute to the program of the building. This is something which is quite typical for postmodernism, this kind of openness. Now, let's broaden the scope. So this is the meaning of postmodernism as it is regularly applied to design, to art, to architecture. But in philosophy, the term postmodernism has a quite different and also quite distinct meaning, which overlaps with the meaning of the term in the world of architecture and design, but is not identical. And this philosophical meaning of the term chiefly derives from the famous book La Condition Postmoderne, The Postmodern Condition, a book from 1979 by the French philosopher Jean-François Lyotard. Lyotard first wrote his book in the form of a report for the Canadian government. He had been invited to reflect on the status of knowledge, savoir in French, today. Savoir is a very broad concept in French. It includes technical knowledge, it includes bookish erudition, it includes everyday philosophy, like you would indicate with the French term savoir-vivre. It also includes very practical knowledge, like savoir-faire is to know how to do something, so practical skills. In other words, with the word savoir, it was the whole of human knowledge that was under discussion. Why was le savoir such an urgent question for the Canadian government and for Lyotard? The first reason came from philosophy and from the humanities in general. During the post-war period, the humanities were strongly influenced by the program of structuralism. Thinkers such as Roland Barthes, Claude Lévi-Strauss, and Pierre Bourdieu started from the idea that comprehensive structures in our minds as well as in our society could explain how individuals lived together and how they produced culture. Their emphasis of these structuralist thinkers was on systems. In other philosophical traditions, the same tendency was noticeable. Logical positivism and the analytical tradition in philosophy saw philosophy as an auxiliary science for mathematics and natural sciences. The so-called postmodern philosophers, such as Lyotard, Derrida, and Jean Baudrillard, were quite skeptical of this scientifically inspired approach to philosophy. They were rather looking for a new philosophical language, which could also be quite literary and quite personal. Above all, they looked at the classical texts of Western philosophy in a whole new way. Because these postmodern or post-structuralist philosophers no longer believed in the importance of general structures to understand all peoples and all cultures, their new kind of thinking was also referred to as post-structuralism, namely that which came after structuralism. A second reason why le savoir, why the status of knowledge today had become a pertinent question, was to be found in the changes that affected society after the Second World War. As the industrialization of the 19th century and the modernism of the early 20th century, after the industrialization of the 19th century and the modernism of the early 20th century, a post-industrial society had come into being. Many observers identified post-industrial society as an information society. What was meant by the term was that an increasing part of the population no longer worked in professions directly related to production or to trade, but held administrative jobs. They were not producing goods or moving goods, transporting goods. They were producing knowledge, producing information. And this was logical because in a world where the speed of production, transport, and trading intensified, the need for control and management also became greater. In 1948, the Jewish-American mathematician Norbert Wiener devised a new term for the discipline that would deal with such issues. He called it cybernetics, or the science of steering, the science of control. The publication of Wiener's book Cybernetics in 1948 and of Lyotard's book The Postmodern Condition in 1979 can be seen as two important points in the development of that new awareness of the information society. For Lyotard, this led to the observation that human beings today had to do without the great narratives, ideologies, philosophical projects, religions of the old days. I will discuss that position in more detail further on in this episode, but first I would like to outline the historical background of this development, which is to be found in the rise of the computer. In the period between 1948 and 1979, a number of significant technological breakthroughs were made in the storage and processing of information. During the Second World War, the first computer prototypes were designed and built, mainly for military purposes. The first functioning computers, for instance, were used to calculate the trajectory of projectiles fired by artillery guns. These prototypes also allowed the Allies to crack the codes of the Enigma cipher machines of the German Wehrmacht. These machines were used to communicate among different divisions of the Wehrmacht, and using the very first computers, it was possible to crack the cipher. Finally, computers were also used by the United States to investigate the feasibility of the hydrogen bomb. In the following years, computers became smaller, more efficient, and cheaper. It was still specialized equipment, mainly used by military forces, governments, very large companies, and universities. As the number of computers in existence became larger, researchers started to investigate how they could be interconnected. Such early networks led to the first rudimentary version of the Internet in 1969. It was only used for applications that passed on textual data or numbers, such as email. In 1972, the first personal computer was introduced, a computer cheap enough to be produced and sold as a mass consumer product. The book by Lyotard appeared just at the moment of the breakthrough of the personal computer, and this underlined how relevant the theme of information processing had become. However, there was another social factor that made The Postmodern Condition, the book, uniquely suited to the historical circumstances at the end of the 20th century. This factor was to be found at the political level and would only fully come into its own in the years after the publication of the book. Let me go a little deeper into this. This is the topic of the end of history, which I now want to discuss. It was the evolution of the information society that brought Lyotard to his diagnosis of the end of the grand narratives. But after the publication of the book, the political events of the 1980s and the 1990s demonstrated the accuracy of his analysis in a new and surprising way. When the book was published, the world was still firmly divided into two ideological camps. The capitalist and liberal outlook of the United States and Western Europe, along with other countries that followed their model in the South and the East, was opposed to the communist outlook of Soviet Russia, the Eastern Bloc, and China. Both camps had their own ideology, their own economic model, and above all, a sufficiently large military arsenal to defend their political program on a global scale. Then, in the course of the 1980s, the economic and political power of the Soviet bloc had been consistently declining. This was due, among other things, to the unwieldy nature of a century-planned economy and to the stifling political unfreedom to which most residents of the Soviet countries were subjected. It was also due to the increasing spread and success of capitalism. 10 years after the appearance of the postmodern condition and the diagnosis of the end of the grand narratives, such a grand narrative actually came to an end with the fall of the Berlin Wall, 1989, the perestroika or restructuring introduced by Mikhail Gorbachev gained momentum. The Soviet Union was dissolved at a rapid pace in the last decade of the 20th century. It led some philosophers to an update of Lyotard's diagnosis, which went much further. A crucial example is the book The End of History and the Last Man from 1992 by the American political scientist Francis Fukuyama. Fukuyama held that the disintegration of the Soviet Union implied the final victory of the Western liberal ideology. The idea of history as the confrontation between different power blocks, each representing a different model of society, was de facto finished. Humankind had arrived at the end of history. What would follow in the coming years, according to Fukuyama, was nothing more than the perpetuation of that victory. The specifically Western combination of economic liberalism, so free market policies, and political liberalism, namely democracy and the multi-party system, proved so successful that it would spread all over the world. During the 1990s, Fukuyama's ideas were identified with a political movement in the United States that was known as neoconservatism. Its central ideas served as the philosophical blueprint for the country's foreign policy. Among other things, the wars waged by the United States in Iraq, 1991 and 2003, and in Afghanistan, 2001, were also legitimized through the supposed superiority of the West's political system. Obviously, if you take the perspective that we took in the previous chapter on post-colonialism, you could just as well see these wars as neo-colonial wars. To conclude, the term postmodernism has different meanings depending on the perspective that you take. In the field of architecture and visual arts, it can mean eclecticism and a refusal of the modernist program of strict functionalism. In philosophy, it designates a certain diagnosis of the information society, as exemplified by Lyotard's work. And at the political level, it can function as a framework to better understand the breakdown of ideological systems, such as communism. In this chapter of the course, postmodernism is mainly used in the second sense of the word, the philosophical sense. However, it was first necessary for me to sketch the artistic and social framework in order to better understand the zeitgeist in which the word came up. Now, let's have a look at our first philosopher from this chapter in more detail, and that is Jean-François Lyotard. The French philosopher and writer Jean-François Lyotard was born in Versailles in 1924. He came from a middle-class family. He spent his school years at the Louis le Grand Lyceum in Paris, just like many other French thinkers of his generation. Think of Jacques Derrida, Alain Badiou, and Pierre Bourdieu. After the Lyceum, he studied philosophy at the Sorbonne. Lyotard graduated with a thesis on the topic of indifference as a moral philosophical concept. He discussed different interpretations of the concept in diverse philosophical systems, such as Zen Buddhism, Stoicism, Taoism, and Epicureanism. After his graduation, Lyotard first worked as a philosophy teacher at a high school in the French colony of Algeria for 2 years. It was a period just before the outbreak of the Algerian War. Lyotard experienced firsthand how colonial exploitation worked. Back in France, he taught at different lycées in Paris and its surroundings. He married André Mé in 1948. The couple had 2 children. Lyotard would marry a second time in 1993 with Dolores Gigic. With her, he had another son, David. During the 1950s, Lyotard also determined his own radical position in politics. At first, he joined the left-wing organization Socialisme ou Barbarie. You can translate this as socialism or barbarism. Lyotard was inspired by communism, but he also highly valued personal freedom. Hence, he could not recognize himself in the authoritarian Soviet regime. And at this time, in the early 1950s, the Stalinist regime was still supported by most of the European communist parties, including the French Communist Party. Out of his growing dissatisfaction with the movement Socialisme Barbarie, he founded a left-wing organization himself in 1959. It was called Pouvoir Ouvrier, which you can translate as the workers' power. With this group, Lyotard criticized the colonial situation in French Algeria and the murderous war that the French army was fighting there. In the same year, 1959, Lyotard became a lecturer of philosophy at the Sorbonne. After obtaining his doctorate in 1971, he started teaching at the Université Paris 8. This university, a new university, located in the Paris suburb of Vincennes, was founded in 1969 and was the product of the student uprisings of May 68, uprisings in which Lyotard himself had played an active role. Student participation and a less authoritarian style of education were high on the agenda when the new institution was launched. It was during this period that Lyotard wrote his most famous book, The Postmodern Condition. It was a report on the role of knowledge in today's society, written at the invitation of the government of Quebec. In addition to his teaching in Vincennes, Lyotard was also a visiting professor at various universities in the United States and at the universities of Montreal and Sao Paulo. In the second phase of his career, Lyotard's work turned to themes from aesthetics. He wrote numerous essays about visual artists, including Valerio Adami, Daniel Buren, Marcel Duchamp, Bracha Ettinger, and Barnett Newman. He developed his philosophical ideas about art in dialogue with Kant's ideas about the sublime. This led to his book Leçons sur l'analytique du sublime, or Lessons on the Analytic of the Sublime, from 1991. In 1985, Lyotard was invited by the French curator Thierry Chaput to collaborate on an exhibition on the topic of matter at the newly opened Centre Georges Pompidou. Under his impetus, the project received a new title, Les Immatériaux, the Immaterials. The building, the Centre Georges Pompidou in Paris, was decidedly a postmodern creation. The architects Richard Rogers and Renzo Piano had conceived it as an inside-out building. All the exhibition halls, structural systems, mechanical systems, circulation, which were normally tucked away behind the facade of a building, were in this case exposed on the exterior of the building. Initially, all of the functional elements were color-coded, green pipes for plumbing, blue ducts for climate control, electrical wires encased in yellow, and circulation elements in red. The exhibition, which Lyotard co-curated, Les Immatériaux, showed recent works by many modern and contemporary artists, including conceptual art and new media art. The show featured different trajectories, which were indicated by philosophical concepts, such as matter, material, matrix, or maternity. Through individual headphones for each visitor, which was a remarkable feat for the time, a different piece of Lyotard's commentary was started by infrared signals at different locations of the exhibition. In 1998, Lyotard died of an advanced form of leukemia. Now, Let me have a closer look at that most famous book of Lyotard, The Postmodern Condition. The starting point of Lyotard's book is the need for legitimation that the progress of science entails in the modern period. What do I mean with this? Science needs, according to Lyotard, a grand narrative. He calls this un grand récit, that justifies the activities of researchers in relation to society. Why are they doing research? What does research do for us as a society? However, science itself cannot and does not want to provide such a narrative. In fact, science is fundamentally hostile to grand narratives. In a religious society, it goes without saying that the grand narrative is provided by religion. But today's society, Lyotard observes, has been a secular society for many centuries, certainly in France, since the introduction of a strict separation between church and state called laïcité during the French Revolution, neutrality of the state. So, modern society assigned this task to philosophy. It is philosophy that should provide a grand narrative with which everybody in society, but especially researchers, scientists, can start to work and from which they can derive their legitimation for their activities. It is only philosophy that has a sufficiently broad view to propose a grand narrative for modern science and modern society. Philosophy functions as the meta-discourse of science. This implies that it is closely related to science but still has a separate status. Philosophers transcend the narrow view of the specialized scientist that enables them to make statements on a much more abstract and fundamental level. So philosophy produces a meta-narrative, a meta-récit. Lyotard uses that word a lot, and it's synonymous for him with grand narrative or grand récit. Examples of such meta-narratives include Hegel's Phenomenology of the Spirit, where the grand narrative consists in the realization of the human consciousness of freedom throughout history, or the Marxist narrative about the uprising of the working class, that's another example, or the liberal narrative of the free market economy and the increasing economic and political freedom for all mankind. Characteristic of a grand narrative is that it not only answers the question of the legitimacy of science, but also many other questions. How is science embedded in society? How should it be embedded? To what extent does current society differ from the ideal society? How are social institutions legitimated? How did society and science develop historically? What is the final aim of that historical development? A meta-narrative about science, in other words, also entails a narrative about politics and history. The meta-narrative is extended with the political philosophy and the philosophy of history. That is indeed what is provided by the great modern philosophers, from Immanuel Kant to Georg Wilhelm Friedrich Hegel, John Stuart Mill, Karl Marx. What Lyotard refers to as the postmodern condition consists in the increasing disbelief regarding such meta-narratives. Ironically, that disbelief is caused and strengthened by the growth of science, which needs such a meta-narrative in the first place. New scientific insights undermine the grand ambitions of the philosophical meta-narratives. The overtone of Lyotard's argument is a far-reaching relativism with regard to grand systems of knowledge, such as philosophy or science. This is often considered as a criticism of his work. He groups all such systems, philosophical systems, scientific systems, under the label of language games, a term that he derives from Ludwig Wittgenstein's Philosophical Investigations. But that very term implies a strong relativizing of the claims to truth and validity from either science or philosophy. Suppose one follows Lyotard's thinking through. Let's apply it to psychology, for example. Both the statements of a cognitive psychologist who works in a scientific way and those of a parapsychologist, so someone defending telepathy or clairvoyance, would then count as being part of the language game of psychology. How can you then criticize the theories of the pseudoscientist? They're both equivalent, or at least they're both on the same level as being both part of the language game of psychology. And that's, of course, a problem. You cannot appeal to a higher notion of truth or value with which to decide that the one is real science and the other is pseudoscience. But on the other hand, what partly supported Lyotard's relativism were the changes that knowledge underwent during the second half of the 20th century. Lyotard points out that the arrival of the information society does not leave the nature of human knowledge untouched. He points to a recent focus in science and technology on the languages in which knowledge is stored and communicated. Let me quote from his book. And it is fair to say that for the last 40 years, the leading sciences and technologies have had to do with language. Phonology, theories of linguistics, problems of communications, cybernetics, modern theories of algebra and informatics, computers and their languages, problems of translation and the search for areas of compatibility among computer languages, problems of information storage and data banks, telematics and the perfection of intelligent terminals, paradoxology. The facts speak for themselves, and this list is not exhaustive. End of quote. So what Lyotard means is that communication and language is becoming a scientific problem of prime importance. This is because knowledge is being quantified more and more and considered as information. Information means exchangeable pieces of knowledge brought together in immense databases and flowing through the world through high-performance communication channels. The result is that there is a separation between knowledge itself, on the one hand, and the one who knows, the knower, on the other hand. A separation between the expert and his expertise. As Lyotard puts it, knowledge is placed outside the knower. That is diametrically opposed to the ideal of knowledge of the 18th and 19th centuries. In that time, the acquisition of knowledge coincided with the education or Bildung of the expert. Lyotard presents a visionary view of information society, which remains surprisingly valid up to today. He predicts that the separation between knowledge and knowers will lead to the commercialization of information. And I quote, "Knowledge is and will be produced in order to be sold. It is and will be consumed in order to be valorized in a new production. In both cases, the goal is exchange. Knowledge ceases to be an end in itself. It loses its use value." End of quote. Today, in a world featuring an internet that is many times more efficient than what Lyotard knew, that prediction came true. The business model of internet companies such as Amazon, Facebook, and Google is based on the information about products, companies, and people they own and can monetize. The enormous exchange value of their quantified data can be deduced from the fact that these companies are worth billions of dollars on the stock market today. Okay, let's have a look at Lyotard's views on aesthetics. From the publication of his doctoral thesis in 1971, aesthetics became more and more prominent in Lyotard's philosophizing. He devoted essays to various modern and contemporary artists. In the field of art philosophy, the notion of the sublime was an important point of reference for Lyotard. The sublime is central to his book Lessons on the Analytic of the Sublime from 1991. The central role in the book is played by Immanuel Kant. In another essay about the sublime, included in his collection L'Inhumain, the Inhuman, from 1988, he leaves Kant aside. The leading role there is played by the definition of the sublime by the Irish philosopher Edmund Burke. Lyotard attempts to transform that definition into a contemporary concept. He wants to explain the titles that painter Barnett Newman gave to some of his paintings, and in which he refers to the sublime. For instance, The Sublime Is Now is the title for from a painting by Barnett Newman from 1948. In the 18th century, Burke had described the sublime as a kind of negative pleasure. The sublime occurs when the threat is first evoked but then taken away again. The first moment, the presence of danger, arouses fear and amazement. The subsequent feeling of escaping the possible sensation of pain is a form of pleasure. More specifically, Burke calls it a delight. He uses that term to make a difference with the positive sensation we feel when confronted with beauty, which he calls pleasure. The sublime therefore consists in evoking a threat that is then kept at a distance and reduced. That second moment he calls suspense, the movement when the feeling of danger is taken away, and that is responsible for the positive sensation of the sublime. Contribution of Lyotard to the psychological description of Burke is small but significant. He zooms in on the first moment of the sublime, the moment of amazement, and he characterizes that moment as eventless. I will now quote from the essay by Lyotard. Here, then, is an account of the sublime feeling. A very big, very powerful object threatens to deprive the soul of any it happens, strikes it with astonishment. The soul is thus dumb, immobilized, as good as dead. Art, by distancing this menace, procures a pleasure of relief, of delight. End of quote. The sublime, as waiting for an event that does not come, according to Lyotard, is an excellent way to understand the work of avant-garde artists such as Barnett Newman. The avant-garde does not focus on any particular subject, but on the naked event of the painting. That is the now that Newman refers to when he gives his paintings titles such as Now or The Sublime Is Now. I quote from Lyotard again. Newman's now, which is no more than now, is a stranger to consciousness and cannot be constituted by it. Rather, it is what dismantles consciousness, what deposes consciousness. It is what consciousness cannot formulate, and even what consciousness forgets in order to constitute itself. What we do not manage to formulate is that something happens, dass etwas geschieht, or rather and more simply, that it happens, das es geschieht. Not a major event in the media sense, not even a small event, just an occurrence. The event happens as a question mark before happening as a question. It happens is rather in the first place, is it happening? Is this it? Is it possible? End of quote. So the now evoked by avant-garde art is something that has not yet been determined by thought. This undeterminedness causes one to have to wait for it. That is the waiting of the artist or of the thinker, not just before the empty canvas, but every time when something or someone leaves you waiting, when you think, and now? This feeling, which can be frightening, but also pleasurable, is sublime. So Lyotard has in this way brought the romantic notion of the sublime into the present. While the romantic sublime has a specific meaning, rough, dark, grand, overwhelming, it is limited here to the moment of waiting for an incident. The indefinite, the happening, is the color, the painting. And I quote, color in its occurrence, the wonder that it happens, it's something, color, at least to the eye. End of quote. I hope you have enjoyed this podcast. Thank you for listening, and I will see you next week.